Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta. Simply better hosting.
Why isn't Channing Tatum in Tron Ares?
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Show it no fear.
You think the rest of it kind of washed away or something?
Here, watch me. Keep your eyes down. Keep your speed up. Avoid those green rocks. And just be fearless.
Wow, you made that look easy.
Yeah, but he's not wearing a whole Dave's World of Camping store on his back.
Hello, everyone. It is Wreckatopia, episode 184. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
And also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hidally ho, Olifanarinos.
Indeed, indeed. And we'd also like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you guys. Thanks for coming out. Today's big recommend is A Perfect Getaway from 2009. Let's get on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
It's an olifant, Mr. Frodo.
My small recommend happens to actually be playing right now on my television, on the channel that I watched it on two or three times over the last month. It's Jack Reacher with Mr. Tom Cruise. Why are you laughing?
He's watching. You're watching the movie while doing the podcast.
I didn't put it on. It's just running. It's playing.
Yeah, it's on the how could you change anything about that situation?
Seriously. So Jack Reacher is on Stars. This is the first Tom Cruise, Christopher McQuarrie pairing that I'm aware of as director and actor. They would go on to, of course, make many Mission Impossible movies, and they worked together on Top Gun Maverick. But this is the first time they worked together, and I understand that for fans of these books, which I have never read, the casting of Tom Cruise was quite the controversy, because Reacher is a man that's supposed to be ginormous, like the Hulk. And Tom Cruise is, as we all know, not ginormous. That being said, if you can put any baggage aside that you have with the books, or if you've never read the books, this is a very entertaining movie to me. The action scenes are really fun. Tom Cruise shines in this kind of a role. He's always the hotshot. The mystery is satisfying. Jai Courtney is good. And Robert Duvall has a small role as the owner of a gun range, and he's really fun and full of life. And it has one of my favorite car chases in it in Pittsburgh, where it kind of stops and starts as they go between streets and alleys, and he loses them, and then they find him, and then such and such. I don't want to ruin the movie for you. I just find it very entertaining. I like the sequel as well. Jack Reacher Never Go Back with Colby Smulders. But I like this one a little better. I have not seen the TV series, so I'm really a Jack Reacher outsider. But the movie really sings to me. It's only like a 60-something on Rotten Tomatoes, which is weird. It's like 7 out of 10 on IMDb, which is pretty good rating for IMDb. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure where you'll fall, but I enjoy it. There you go. What's my small recommend?
I really like Jack Reacher quite a bit. I'm not a big fan of the sequel, though. I thought that was actually legitimately bad. But you know, But the first one's good, and I love the opening of that, of Jack Reacher, with the just looking through the little scope and all that, and then, you know, you think you know exactly what happened there, but there's so many other things, so many other details to that whole opening that are really illuminating as it goes on. The funny thing about, I think this, it wouldn't have satisfied readers of this franchise, but it for me, who also haven't read the books or whatever, the funny thing to me is there's a part where he's getting framed for something, and the hotel clerk or the motel clerk describes him as this huge person, like, yes. They just completely forgot about that in the writing, and it's like, no, this is not that. Was Alan Rich?
Right.
I can't remember.
Richson.
Richson something. I can't remember who does the guy in the TV show. I've seen the first season of the TV show, which is really, really good, by the way. I haven't seen the other seasons, but yeah, I really like this. I really like this one quite a bit. Really good movie.
I do too. In fact, I share both of your opinions, Chris. I think the first one is great and the second one is not great. And that's kind of my opinion. I think this is one of my favorite runs of Tom Cruise, when he did Jack Reacher, Oblivion, and Edge of Tomorrow, like back to back to back. And I feel like Reacher and Oblivion especially are these underrated great Tom Cruise films that just, you know, people forget that he did. So yeah, I really like the first Jack Reacher for sure.
Yeah, it is Alan Richson who does the TV series.
Nice.
Dicer, what do you got?
I got Tron Ares.
You're the contrarian on this one, I think.
Yes.
This is my trademark, stump speeching for apparently bad movies. But I think this one for me is a little bit different in that I'm not sure I'm here to say this is a great quote unquote movie. I think what I'm here to say is this is one of the greatest movie going experiences I've ever had. And those are two different things, and sometimes they're hard to distinguish. In many ways, this is my, like, The Raid, right? Where it's like, yeah, the story is the story, whatever the story is, but did you see what happened in that movie? Like, this is Tron Ares for me. I watch it, and I go, I'm blown away by everything on screen. The Nine Inch Nails soundtrack is absolutely insane in that Dolby surround, you know? It's just, this is a feast for the senses in a way that I have rarely experienced. Now, I will say I saw it in IMAX Laser 3D. So I think the 3D here is a big part of this. I have been a proponent of 3D. I continue to be a proponent of 3D when it's used correctly. And in this case, I think it adds a lot to this experience and to this story with what's going on. Now, beyond that, the actual movie part of things. I thought everybody in this was adequate to good. I really identified with a lot of the themes of how technology changes. I think it really feels like a Tron movie. Like, it feels like a lot of those themes really tie into the first and second movies and kind of what they're talking about with this idea of, you know, artificial life coming from digital life and what that means and what that looks like. I actually think the taking the digital world and bringing it to the real world stuff is done in a really smart way, in that it there's a 3D printing element to it that I think makes it feel more realistic than upon first thinking about that would be. I found it really fascinating, interesting, but mostly of all, just a really fun watch. I had a great time watching this movie.
There is a lot of curious things about this movie being made, though. And it was brought up, I think, pretty ad nauseum over the weekend, because obviously it didn't do the kind of business they were hoping it was going to do.
No.
But that's just what Tron does, right? The first Tron was not a huge hit. It became kind of a cult favorite on video. They took forever to actually come out with a sequel that, again, nobody watched, and everybody was excited, really more excited about the Daft Punk soundtrack than they were the movie itself. Although I think I'm with the company of people who love Tron Legacy. I personally didn't. I personally didn't. I haven't seen it in since it came out or since we send it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so I may give it another chance one day, but I didn't like it when I saw it. And now there's this one, and it's like, what has Tron done to make Disney say, let's come out with another one? And then the Jared Leto thing, like, what has Jared Leto done to keep putting him in movies like this as the headlining star? And it's like, has he done anything that people like, they're drawn to him?
He's not bad here. I do think it's unfortunate that conversation outweighs Greta Lee and Evan Peters, who I think are both really good here. I think they both are doing really good work, but all the focus is on why does Jared Leto keep getting movies, and I totally understand that focus. But,
well, didn't they sink a couple hundred million into a Tron ride?
Yeah. World? Oh, yeah. It's IP. The Disney thing. It's about IP. It's about, you know, getting IP into their parks, and yeah.
I guess that makes some sense.
I don't think they need this movie to make a ton of money, but like you said, Chris, I think all the Tron movies have become ultimately. All the first two Tron movies have ultimately become cult hits after performing poorly at the box office. That may happen to this one as well. When I saw the trailer for this and saw that the idea was essentially it's Tron shit, but it's in the real world now, I was sold. Like, I'll watch it. I'm excited to watch it. And then I know the soundtrack is going to be great. And yeah, it looks visually like a friend of mine, saw it and said he thought it was really bad, and I said, well, was it at least fun to look at? And he said, yeah, it was. So that's all I really need. So yeah.
It does make me wonder though if everything is all around the fact that they've made a ride or something for it, you know, what exactly does coming out with a movie no one's going to see do for that ride? So I kind of want to know.
I think it's just a cycle, right? I think that there are kids that are going to see the movie on Disney Plus at some point and then want to go to the ride. And I think there are kids at the park who ride the ride and then they're going to be like, there's a movie about that? I want to see that.
Yeah, maybe so.
It's a light cycle, if you will.
Somebody in the comments says what my friend Patrick already told me, that the ride is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think it's keeping the brand in the public consciousness. So like all the advertising they're doing for the movie is also for the brand itself, you know.
Yeah.
Keeps it in people's minds.
I think so.
I guess somewhere there's a bottom line that says this was all worth it.
Well,
so.
And again, they might be wrong. They might be wasting money. That's very, very possible.
But, remember that Star Wars immersive hotel they built? Remember that?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Remember God. That?
They burned so much money on that.
I watched the full 4.5-hour video by Jenny Nicholson where she went through and she went through every single like part of it and reviewed all of it and everything. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
All right. My small recommend is also a movie that came out, I think, this past weekend. It's called Roof Man, starring Channing Tatum and Kirsten Dunst. It is about a guy who started robbing some McDonald's because he has a daughter that he wants to like give all the best things in life to and everything. And he gets caught doing it, but he leaves kind of a calling card, an inadvertent calling card, is that he's very, very nice and polite. And so like when he tells these McDonald's employees while he's gonna steal from their safe, he tells them to get in the freezer, and the one manager didn't bring a coat, and he's like, what are you doing now, it's so cold outside, why didn't you bring a coat? So he takes his own coat off of himself to give to the manager. Unfortunately, all this free spending of all the money that he has stolen gets him on the radar of the police. I don't know how. So he gets taken to jail, and then he finds a way to escape from the jail. And instead of just trying to make a run for the border, he makes a run for the Toys R Us that he can just break into. And he sort of sets up a kind of a living quarters hidden from everybody's view. And what follows follows is kind of like a Career Opportunities, if you ever remember that movie, where, you know, it's not Frank Whaley like falling in love with Jennifer Connelly or anything like that. It's just, you know, it's just he's going through the store, he's learning things he can steal from the store, he's learning things about the employees, he's learning all this stuff. Eventually he meets Kirsten Dunst, who works at the store, and they start a relationship, which is what I hear is a bad thing to do when you're on the run from the law. So you don't really want to start relationships with that kind of baggage.
Also, what do you do when she says, I want to see your place?
Well, he of course, he does the whole, like, I'm working for the government and I can't tell you where I live type of thing.
Nice.
This is based on a true story. They even have a whole bunch of stuff at the end where the actual people are talking about what happened and everything. I'm sure, much like a lot of these type of movies, they changed some details here and there to make it more of a movie and everything. But Channing Tatum is very good. I didn't think much of Channing Tatum when I first saw him early on, when he was doing, he did Step Up. I thought he was just another one of these good looking dudes with a shirt off or whatever, you know, like this is what he's going to be. That's what he's going to be for the rest of his life. But he really has, over the last 20 years, he's really become kind of a go-to guy, man. I've come to the point of welcoming Channing. Why isn't Channing Tatum in Tron Ares? And Kirsten Dunst has become a terrific actor. Like, I've always liked her, but, like, I think she's so good now. And I'm wondering if, like, you know, all that time with Jesse Plemons and everything, it's like there's this whole, like, thing going on where they're, like, trying to top each other now and everything. Mm-hmm. And, like, they've just become extremely good at what they do. I've always liked Kirsten Dunst, but I think she's become even better now in her 40s. So, anyway, this is a very entertaining movie. Peter Dinklage is in it. He's awesome as the Toys R Us manager. Yeah, really fun movie.
Man, I did not. This is the first time even hearing of this movie. Like, somehow, and I love that this can happen because I consume about as much entertainment news as is humanly possible. And yet, there's still so much of it. Here's a movie with a bunch of stars in it that I know that I've never even heard of. But when you said something about McDonald's robberies, I thought, oh, this is a true story. I think I remember reading about this. So
yeah,
I'll have to check it out.
And I've apparently stumbled on one that Aaron hasn't seen.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to get out and see it yet. But I am excited to see it because, like you, I think Channing Tatum is always interesting and you know, chooses interesting projects, and so yeah, I'm interested to see it.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, and it is Jeremy's turn. The movie is Roof Man. The movie is A Perfect Getaway. Jeremy, take it away.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Perfect Getaway from Mr. Brooks. A Perfect Getaway is a 2009 thriller starring Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich as a pair of newlyweds on their honeymoon in Hawaii. As opposed to going to a resort like a normal couple, Cliff and Sydney are going to do some remote hiking and camping. Yes, like outside in nature with all the spiders and stuff. And they're here for a fairly famous remote trail. I'm going to butcher all these Hawaiian names. Kalalau, a real-life trail that is considered one of the most beautiful and dangerous in all the world. Before hitting the trail, they stop off for some supplies, where the shop owner doesn't like Cliff's chances of completing the hike in 3 days, but he does like Cliff's chances at a second blowjob in the car after Sydney openly offers it in front of him. Also, there is a young worker who helps them load their car. His name might be Chekhov. As the vehicle backs out, we see the newspaper they have parked on has a front page headline reading, "Young couple butchered in Honolulu." Dun, dun, dun. Along the road to the trail, Sydney completely harmlessly remarks about loving their new lives before they decide to stop and pick up two people walking on the road. And it's angry Thor and his girlfriend. Thor has a tattoo that says, "Do not revive." And the newlyweds decide to lie and say they aren't going as far as the couple needs them to go before Cleo, the girlfriend, starts showing them photos, and they change their minds and offer the ride. But Thor, whose name is Kale, isn't having it. He's been offended, and he demands Cleo get the fuck out of this man's ride.
Mm-hmm.
Just a ways into the trail, on the first day, they come to a seemingly impossible wet cliff section. Suddenly, Timothy Oliphant shows up, and he crosses it easily. Cliff then crosses, and finally Sydney crosses, but a jump-scaring bastard of a helicopter startles her until Oliphant grabs her arm and pulls her across.
Them helicopters always sneaking up on you.
That's what they do best.
Uh-huh.
His name ends up being Nick. Nick thinks he recognizes Cliff. Maybe Cliff's an actor, but it turns out Cliff is a screenwriter. Nick's a bit of a writer himself, and even read a book about screenwriting. And his demeanor and questions kind of annoy Cliff. He's a very aggressive personality. The group comes upon a trio of girls who tell them that there have been some murders on the other island. They learn the suspects are a man and a woman, which Nick notes is like the movie Natural Born Killers, while making no mention of Brad Pitt's California with a K. Cliff and Sydney decide to continue the hike despite the news of the murders. Nick also mentions he's headed back to his campsite at a falls, and he had only run back to the truck for some extra butane. Cliff sees that the couple they stranded on the trail or on the road are behind them on the trail, so they decide to change their plans and hike off the path with Nick to the falls. There, they find Nick's completely naked girlfriend as Nick strips and joins her in the water. They didn't even previously know Nick was here with anybody else. Sydney takes off her clothes and gets in the water while Cliff climbs up the cliff to try and get a better cell phone reception. There, Googling on a hilariously dated 2008-ish phone, Cliff learns that authorities believe the killers, who removed teeth and fingerprints from their victims, have jumped to the smaller island Cliff and Sydney are now on. As he loads a photo of the suspect, he is startled by the sudden appearance of Kale and Cleo. Kale ominously talks about how people probably die out on this trail all the time. He's confrontational with Cliff, calling him on his lies and blocking the path when Cliff tries to leave. Just as the confrontation heats up, Nick shows up and disrupts things enough that he and Cliff leave. Nick and Gina decide to tag along on the hike with the newlyweds. Before heading out, Cliff realizes he's lost the permits and goes digging around in Kale's bag, finding a business card for Ernesto Padillo, a California parole agent. The foursome then begins hiking again, and I don't know if they filmed this movie at the actual trail, but this place is beautiful and dangerous as hell. Mm-hmm. On the journey, Nick tells some wild stories, wild enough to make one wonder if he's full of shit. And Gina proves to be my kind of gal by firing up a joint to make the hike and Nick's stories more bearable. Nick used to be Special Forces, he says, and calls himself an American Jedi, exactly the kind of person that might have a violent streak and be a killer. He starts talking as though Cliff is going to write his next movie about Nick. Gina says of Nick, he's really hard to kill. And Cliff and Sydney exchange a perfectly harmless glance that means nothing. Cliff creates a private moment by having Sydney pretend to pee and shows her the photo of the murder suspect. He seems to think it's Nick and Gina in the photo. Cliff then asks, what do we really know about these people aside from their stories? And movie, you are walking a very fine line right now. Due to the huge storm that suddenly approaches, they are forced to stop and camp for the night. And Chekhov's butane finally returns to cook some dinner. Cliff proves to be terrible at setting up a tent, while Nick is basically Bear Grylls. Oh, and we see a shadowy figure walk by their campsite in the woods, just before Nick starts staring into the woods. He ultimately says, probably just a goat. Cliff says, I haven't seen any goats. And Nick responds, I don't expect you would, Cliff. Your situational awareness kind of sucks. Timothy Oliphant then has a bunch of fun with a monologue about how aware he is of everything when he boards a plane, while he's also putting together a bow. Nick just assumes Cliff will go goat hunting with him, and when Cliff declines, Nick goes all here kitty 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 in a condescending way that still made all my cats run into my office. Cliff says the taunts don't work on him, but we cut straight to him following Nick in the woods. In the woods, in the rain, Nick says to Cliff, it crossed my mind... that it crossed your mind that we're the ones, me and Gina. Cliff denies that and says lots of people were on Oahu when the murders happened. He then says, we're not really hunting goats here, are we? And Nick replies, no. Nick says there are two people who are shadowing them who have taken two looks at the camp and then took cover somewhere here in the woods. We cut back to the camp as Gina lights up the joint again And I'm beginning to think Gina likes weed. Mm-hmm. Cindy talks about having 5 kids in the future and describes her perfect future with Cliff. Gina retorts with a story about a preacher getting caught with a male prostitute that is so realistic a thing to happen, it almost pulled me out of this fictional movie. And then says, so now when people tell me about their perfect life, I don't believe them. But we cut back to the men in the woods before getting any reply from Sydney other than, Nick fucks with Cliff using military hand signals before we're walking off, just as Cliff spots a nearby campfire. Sydney's response ultimately is to tell a story that is probably 100% true, despite how horrifying it is, before a jump-scaring bastard of a huge dead palm leaf falls on the tent. At the camp in the woods, it turns out to be the kid from the shop who loaded Cliff's gear into the Jeep, who has come deep into the fucking jungle to give Cliff his permits, which he had left behind. He thought he'd seen Cliff at the camp, but because there were 4 peeps, he didn't think it was him, so he and his lady made camp. And honestly, this character deserves Employee of the Month or something. This is a hell of a lot more than turning a lost wallet into the police station. This trail is deadly. And yeah, he's local and probably knows it well, but he spent more than a day trying to reunite a dumb American with a piece of paper. Cliff returns to camp alone, shortly followed by Nick, who is carrying a wild goat for dinner. The movie makes the interesting choice of showing us a good portion of the breaking down of the carcass, which I don't appreciate. Afterwards, in their tent, Cliff tells Sydney that Nick and Gina are officially crazy. Which is a hell of a thing to say, given what we don't yet know about Cliff and Sydney. Sydney says, let's pack our bags and get out of here. But Cliff convinces her they need to ride this out and go the last 2 miles to the beach. In the morning, Cliff wakes to the sound of a police helicopter. It passes by them and then, at the next cliff, starts calling to unknown people to put their hands out. And it turns out to be Cale and Cleo. The cops stop the foursome from getting too close to the arrests, but we do see that the cops find a container of teeth in Cale's backpack. Gina jokes to Cliff and Sydney, I thought it might have been you guys. And to be clear, once the movie continues after the arrests of Cale and Cleo, it should be obvious to any viewers that the killers are one of the 2 couples we've got left and not Cale and Cleo. But perhaps some viewers think the movie is going to resolve the killer mystery, but then still have 40 minutes left where the non-killer characters play on the beach and have blowjobs and goat meat. Anyway, Cliff convinces Nick to go kayak to some caves by appealing to his vanity about the movie project, and Nick goes for it. And this is the moment I think a lot of viewers' subconscious starts to make some noise. Gina shows up and just picks up Cliff and Sydney's camcorder and starts snooping through it like a snooping snooper. But also, Cliff and Sydney are really fucking stupid for leaving everything on this camcorder or memory card or whatever is in there. Like, stupid with a capital, are you freaking kidding me? Gina quickly deduces that Cliff and Sydney were not who they said they were, largely because the wedding photos don't match. She tries to yell for Nick, but he's too far out on the water to hear what she's saying. So she takes off, trying to find a place above sea level that has access to the caves Nick is headed to. Sydney then arrives at the camcorder and realizes Gina has figured things out and chases after her. Gina finds a video game wall she has to climb, and the movie just jumps right over all the struggle that it would have been and shows her arriving at the top while Sydney arrives at the bottom. In the cave, I cannot tell for sure, but I think Nick's alcohol question about the scorpion somehow makes him realize he is the scorpion and he's about to die, as Cliff decides to throw Nick's words about situational awareness back in his face and shoot him, instead of just shooting him. And for a killer that likes to collect the teeth and fingerprints of their victims, I gotta say, shooting someone in a kayak, in an ocean cave, seems like a really stupid plan. Before we learn how the shooting played out, we're treated to an extensive flashback. And when I say extensive, I truly mean it. Showing Cliff and Sydney killing and taking over the personalities of various people. And that Nick had planned to propose to Gina on the beach in Hawaii. And honestly, it's a lot of black and white flashback. And I'll admit, it's a lot. The movie thinks it's important for us to see them smoking crack or meth because after Cliff shoots Nick, Cliff's teeth go from white to pretty messed up. Sydney catches up to Gina and the two fight, but Gina ultimately wins by dodging the knife attack, sending Sydney plummeting into the ocean cave below, but leaving Gina with a knife in her leg, which she pulls out immediately like a moron. Gina then learns the cave is empty, and she goes walking towards the edge of the cliff for some reason. I suppose she's looking for Cliff or Sydney. But then her phone rings. Unknown caller. It's a sales call from an AT&T guy named Woody. And she tries explaining to him the current situation. She begs him to send help before she sees Sydney rowing a kayak out of the cave. Suddenly, Cliff appears, just climbing atop the cliff, and grabs her. She kicks him and gets away, and he fires blindly as she runs away, managing to hit her at least once. She grabs the knife and stabs his hand into the rock before he has completely climbed up. He then radios to Sydney, who heads for the beach as he chases after Gina on foot. Back at the cave, we learn Nick actually is very hard to kill, as he was faking dead and breathing under his overturned kayak. And the story about the metal plate in his head from earlier is true, and that's what deflected the bullet and kept him alive. We then get a really cool moment where everyone is racing through the woods and the presentation of the frames changes, setting up two or three frames within a single shot that rapidly slide to the right or the left, and it's not something that I've seen a lot in any other movies, and it's pretty cool. Gina is now climbing down the wall. We never got to see her climb up, and we only get to see the last couple of seconds of her climbing down, and I'm starting to think this wall is not climb upable or climb downable. There are four men at the bottom who recognize that she's in distress and injured, and they refuse to let her leave, because four men will always think they know better than a single woman. Unfortunately, this gives Cliff Rocky time to climb down the wall, super fast like Spider-Man, and he starts spinning a story about crystal meth use. Gina responds by yelling, "He wants to be us! He and his girlfriend want to be us!" Which is super true, but also gives Cliff Rocky the benefit of her sounding like an insane crystal meth user. The dudes end up not trusting Cliff Rocky because his pupils are huge, which is wild, but he just pulls out his gun and shoots them as Gina gets away. He reloads, only for Nick to land on top of him and stab his hand, having jumped from above. Cliff Rocky picks up the gun with his split-open hand and fires wildly, while Nick calmly approaches, disarms him, and then puts the gun at his neck and asks, "How many people?" The cops show up in a chopper and think Nick is the bad guy because, dun-dun-dun, Sydney's in the chopper. And the sniper actually says to her, "I have to know I'm about to kill the right man," as those snipers just take eyewitnesses' word before summarily killing folks. At the last minute, Gina rushes in and pulls Nick off of Cliff Rocky. Cliff mouths off to Nick, and Gina kicks him in the face. Back in the helicopter, Sydney decides to betray her Cliff Rocky, saying he was the one who was guilty after having just fingered the other guy. And then the cops summarily shoot Cliff Rocky. And holy shit, I like this movie, but it's insane. In the Jurassic Park helicopter after, Nick shows Gina the ring and proposes. But as cheesy as this ending is, I still love this movie. And that is a perfect getaway. Gentlemen, what say you?
I never thought that when we started this podcast that we would have two David Toohey movies featured in the long list of movies we've done. We did Pitch Black earlier, so it was fun to see his name pop up again. It's like friend of the show now, David Toohey. This was a pleasant surprise back in 2009 when I watched this at Hollywood 27, still being a projectionist and everything. I didn't know much about this movie, and I watched it late one night, and I was like, okay, what this movie does is it just kind of lets you bathe in the Hawaii of it all. Though I saw in the chat this movie I guess was shot mostly in Puerto Rico, I guess. But it lets you bathe in the Hawaii that it's presenting or whatever, and so it does feel like, just okay, this must be some regular ass thriller, right, where it's like, you know, an innocent couple goes to Hawaii, and which couple could be the murdery couple that we've been hearing about. It's a very hard thing this movie has to do, because it's obvious that there was a big surprise that they wanted to do. How do you make the movie interesting enough that you'll want to get to the surprise? Because this is just kind of pretty just a regular movie for a while, a regular thriller. So like, what keeps you there? And I think casting certainly helps when you have somebody like Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich, and then you have Timothy Oliphant, and then Kaylee Sanchez. That's an interesting casting too, because she, at this point in time, I think she's best known as one of the twins that everybody hated in Lost. Remember when they had the twins on Lost? She was one of those twins, and that's what she's best known as. Chris Hemsworth, I'd forgotten, was in this movie. I don't think anybody knew who Chris Hemsworth was, really, when this movie came out. And then Marley Shelton, who I think deserves more work and has never seemed to ever, you know, she's like a, almost like a Judy Greer to me, like just doesn't get enough. But casting these people is a big step to trying to make people interested in something where you don't know that there's a surprise on the way. Now they hint at it. Timothy Olyphant's, you know, talking about the surprise. Oh, that'd be a big surprise about the you know, about the killers with this or right. whatever. And they even, if you're really paying attention to that beginning wedding thing, yes. you'll realize that Steve Zahn, who has said he's a screenwriter, they're sitting there talking about banking and crap in that wedding thing. So, like, if you're really, really paying attention, you're going to be like, why is Cliff talking about screenwriting? I thought he was a banker or whatever. You will kind of know that he's lying about this, or at least the footage at the beginning is not talking about Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich. And you're right about that fine line that they have to navigate when they're sitting there talking about, they see the picture. They're like, does that look something like somebody familiar to you and all that? And then they start, what do we know about these people? Do we even care if you're killers, do you even care about what these other two people are up to? You're the ones who are, you know, you're the ones that have the advantage here of, like, you know, so it is kind of a weird thing. Also, could they see her peeing up there? Because, like, that seemed to have a pretty good view of where they were.
I think it's supposed to be clear that they know she's not actually peeing. But again, and I don't want to interrupt your thing, but again, the movie plays off that casting. You have Timothy Olyphant, who's good at playing an edgy, scary person, and you have Steve Zahn, who's almost never played that kind of person. He's always the guy you root for, and that I think is what makes the movie work for the people it works for.
Well, thanks, Jeremy. I was going to get to that. Was going to mention the fact that Timothy Olyphant was known as a bad guy, and it was very, very clear, like, they were going on your audience expectation there. Steve Zahn, never a bad guy in these movies. You know, he's always the goofball in everything. You know, that thing you do is what's going to run through your head a lot of times when you're watching this. So, like, it definitely has the good play on your expectations, for sure, no doubt about it. I've always enjoyed this movie. It becomes, like, a little bit harder to watch on the second viewing, because at this point you're kind of like, okay, why are you acting this particular way
right
during all of this? You know, you and you guys are doing a really good job of, like, not talking about your crimes all the, you know, even though we're spending all of our time with you the entire, you know, so they really got into character. They're really, like, making that a whole thing, right? Like, they studied these people on the videotape so long that they've become like Daniel Day-Lewis or something, and they don't even talk about the crime. They don't even know they committed a crime. In fact, that's how method they've become.
One of the things I think that the movie does that's interesting, and I think the way I've always interpreted the movie, and I could be wrong, is that he's new to screenwriting. He even says, like, got my first feature in pre-production right now. So I think what they do is they kill people and then they take over their lives. They become them. And so, and even the girl at the end says he wants to be us. So I think the movie is trying to cover up all of the, how much do we really know about these people, by saying they're sizing them up as, do we want to be them? Do we want to kill them and take over their personalities? I think it's a very fine line. But I think that's what the movie's trying to say is the reason for those interactions.
Yeah, I get you. What you got, Aaron?
You guys made my job really easy. Jeremy, you are a man in full. But I do not like this movie as much as you did. Chris, you just keep shaking that bush, man. Just keep shaking that bush.
All right.
For this movie.
Keep fucking that chicken.
That's right. Exactly. This movie didn't capture me, except for what you mentioned about Zahn and Olyphant. So I'll just start there. I think especially Timothy Olyphant has this charisma that I will just watch. Like, he can be in Alien Earth playing a completely emotional, less, you know, android. Mm-hmm. And somehow I'm still drawn to his charisma. Like, he's just that good. And I really do like him here. And Steve Zahn's always fun to watch as well. Yeah, you guys mentioned all the things that just took me out of this movie. Like, I just could not find my way into this movie. I will restate them kind of through my own lenses as I saw them. So much of the foreshadowing in this movie, to me, was so heavy that it was just like complete shadowing. That story about the hanging of that Sydney tells or whatever was like, if you don't know they're the bad guys at that point, like, what else is that story supposed to tell us? Like, it's a really weird moment in the movie that I just kind of lays all its cards out there. By the way, this is the first time I've seen this movie. I didn't even know this movie existed until you recommended it this week. This movie is so messy with its plot threads and everything that it lays out. The movie almost wants you to think like the store owners they come into contact are a little bit creepy and weird, and that guy comes in and who are these people, and that just never goes anywhere. We don't like, I guess when he comes to see them in the woods, that's supposed to be something, but I don't know like what that was supposed to make us feel or, you know, make us think or make us do or why we needed to spend the time on that. I don't understand the decision not to show Chris Hemsworth's face when they meet. Like, what is the storytelling, or, you know, I'm sure the director had a reason, you know, I'm sure there was something he was thinking, but it just doesn't really ever pay off in really any interesting way. Like, was Chris Hemsworth known enough at that point to be like, oh, it's a Chris Hemsworth cameo?
No, he was not. Done Cabin in the Woods, maybe, by then?
No, I don't think he's even done Cabin in the Woods at this point. So no, Cabin in the Woods came out in 2012. I really think that they're setting up, of course, he doesn't need to set all these things up where the couples, the red herring couples, he's trying to get you to think, okay, Chris Hemsworth and Marley Shelton are the bad couple or whatever. But then not too long after that, we're running into Timothy Oliphant and Keely Sanchez, and Timothy Oliphant has a certain way about him. That's like, and they don't cut off his face when they show him. So yeah, right. I was wondering that too myself. So yeah.
I didn't understand that. And then when the twist finally is revealed, and Jeremy, you mentioned it in your summary, it goes on for all of the blue shaded sometime. Like, it is one of the longest, here's what really happened segments I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
And it's going over all these details that just don't like matter. Like, they show him practicing the screenwriter line. Like, what? Like, he's like, oh, I gotta get, I'm a screenwriter. I'm a screenwriter. Like, what? It really, at that point, I was out. I was just like, okay. There may be some fun actors in this. There may be some fun moments in this, but this is just a messy movie that I'm just having a hard time getting into.
This is fair. This is fair. 2/3 of us enjoy it, and that's about what the internet said. So,
yeah. And I'm seeing in the chat that the whole cutting off his face was to make him menacing and scary. I think saying get the fuck out of the car is enough.
You
don't really have to hide his face. Usually, when you hide someone's face, there's a reason behind it. Like, for the audience, like, there, it's usually like, oh, who could be playing this person or whatever. And like, it's always weird when they do that with somebody who at that time wasn't even all that well known.
The last thing I want to do is like try and defend this movie.
No, it's fine.
I agree with you that camera work is intentional. I assumed it was because the intent was to give us the perspective of Cliff and Sydney, who currently can't see his face, to help us again think they're another layer of subconscious, that they're good guys. They're the good guys. We're seeing this from their perspective. They're your protagonists. I don't know that it works, but that would be my reason for, I don't know.
I mean, hey, man, they had a great shot of Chris Hemsworth undressing in the side view mirror. He could have seen his face in that, too. But, you know, they didn't show that.
Maybe you can remind me. I don't remember completely, and it doesn't matter too much to the point, but what is the order of when the twist is revealed as it relates to the engagement ring conversation? In my mind, the engagement ring conversation comes before the twist is officially revealed, but I'm not sure of that. I just remember thinking the movie wants me to like this couple and to be, you know, foreshadowed about this couple so much that I just think it, for as hard as it hits that twist, it shows its hand a lot. And so it makes it seem even longer than it needs to be based on what we've seen before. And the primary thing I'll come back to is the line that you guys say the movie has to walk. I don't think it walks that line very well at all. Like, I think you think back now, I've only seen it once and you guys have seen it twice. So you guys actually have the better perspective on this. But it seems to me like the best thing you can say about a movie that has a big twist is that it's better watching it the second time because you can see how that, you know, twist impacts. And in this movie, I think it's almost worse, I would imagine, watching it the second time because of how they're having to walk that line and it feels unnatural.
When did you solve it, Aaron? When did you solve it?
I solved it the hanging story. Was it a, I forget what animal.
Oh, really? The hanging story told you that was the yeah. twist. That you knew was a twist coming.
I mean, this kind of movie, especially with, like you said, with Timothy saying, oh, there's always a second act, you know, thing that happens. And
right.
I'm just saying the movie wants to do a lot of foreshadowing and just ends up showing its hand.
I think that's absolutely fair. I do want to read one IMDb trivia entry, if I may. Timothy Olyphant and Steve Zahn went to Jamaica to film the cove sequence in the kayaks. Olyphant said, the rest of this is all a quote, "You can get weed from anyone in Jamaica. You don't buy it because everyone has it. There's no weed for sale. One time I walked by the gardener of the hotel and he reeked of weed. When you go to the lobby, they're all so high. You can get room service to bring you weed. I'm not making it up. They'll leave it on your bedside table, part of the turndown service, just a little joint on the bedside table."
I know somebody who's going to Jamaica after this.
I was going to say, now that describes half the cities in the United States of America, too.
Yeah, you know, possibly. Possibly, yes. Yeah.
So anyways, I certainly have my own messy movies that I really, really like or love. And we've talked about some of them on this show. So, like, I am in no place to judge. But, yeah, I didn't enjoy this movie.
That's fair. That is absolutely fair.
I don't think it is. I think we should all like the movies that we introduce, and then we can all be in harmony.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. That's how it should be.
Well, I'm curious to see what you guys got for this next segment.
Absolutely. All right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta. Simply better hosting.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, you definitely cannot take away mine, so... Go.
I wouldn't think that I wouldn't think that I am. I'm going with Dave Franco's first directed movie and written movie, The Rental. And I don't know if either of you have actually seen this.
I have, and we actually interviewed one of the actresses from this movie.
That's right. Yep. So yeah, I kind of enjoyed this movie. It has a lot of the same couple. Who's the bad person? Who's the good person? What's going on here? And it involves remote vacationing as well. So it felt like a good possible double feature.
Yeah, and this is a pretty good movie. I actually pretty much enjoyed this movie. So it's not. I don't think it's got a high rating. It's not like something that everybody you gotta go rush out and see. But I thought it was pretty good.
Yep.
Mine has a slightly different feel to it and everything. But I was thinking about serial killers taking people's identities and everything like that, and I settled on T2 Judgment Day. That is where you have the T-1000 is going around and imitating people as they kill and everything. Obviously, they're not trying to become those people, but I was trying to come up with one that was a little off kilter from the usual. There's a couple of others out there. I haven't seen Taking Lives in forever, but that was a movie that popped. It's about a serial killer who takes the identities of their victims and everything. And then I even thought of Talented Mr. Ripley, but we have used that twice in this show, so there's no way I was going to use that one on for a third time for sure. But yeah, T2 was one. I was like, there's one. Like, trying to watch Perfect Getaway and T2 back to back and see if you can come up with the shared themes or shared connections between those two movies.
I did too. The other ones I thought of were Gone Girl. Has a lot of the same, flip it on its head kind of stuff. And then as far as like environmental thriller adventure, The Edge always comes up in my brain.
I love that movie. There's some in the chat saying we should have stuck with Mr. Brooks. Well, where were we going to find watching Mr. Brooks? Were we all going to like order the Blu-ray? That's the reason why we changed. So there, chat. I'm going to stick it to you today. Stick it to you. I mean, thank you for being here. Please be here all the time, but I'm going to stick it to you today. All right. What is next week's homework? It is Aaron's turn. And I hear that you have a movie that just goes right along with all these violent pictures that we have been doing so far.
No, but it does have somebody who worked in the sound department of the last two movies as well.
Oh, okay. Sweet.
So there is a connection. This might be another example of a movie that I just have a lot of grace for and might not be that great. I think it's, if I'm looking, right about that 60% on Rotten Tomatoes, So it's very similar kind of idea, but I went with Secondhand Lions. This is Michael Caine and Robert Duvall, and they are kind of in charge of Haley Joel Osment as a child, because he's doing some adult acting now, some really fun parts Haley Joel has been doing lately on TV and some different places. So I remember this being heartwarming and wonderful and really funny, and so I'm interested in going back and checking it out. I have not seen it in probably 20 years, so it'll be interesting to check it out.
And I have never seen it. It did come out during the time I was working at Hollywood 27, and I remember it coming out, and I was like, Secondhand Lions, fuck that, I'm not watching that. And this was also during the years where Haley Joel Osment was going from child actor to the awkward teen years and everything. And it's like Come on, Haley Joel Osment. Why can't you be in more Forrest Gumps and Sixth Senses? Like, that's something that you should be able to do in your sleep now. And he's in this movie.
Pay
anyway.
It forwards.
Right. Pay it forwards. Exactly. But yes, I do want to see this. It's got IMDb, I think, has got it at a 7, which is, I think, higher than it was when it first came out. So it looks like it's maybe possibly gotten some sort of following since it came out.
Yeah.
Slab says he saw the prequel Minute Hand Lines.
That sounds like a sequel.
Yeah, it does. All right, looks like we have time for a question. Let's look at what we got here.
Question. I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What's your favorite throwaway line? Meaning a line that is not the main line of the scene or moment, but something someone in the background says or that a side character utters after the main character's line that is still audible. And I think this is a little bit too much definition of a throwaway line, because a lot of times throwaway lines are just exactly that. They just threw it out there, and then they go on. They move through the scene. It doesn't do anything after that. What do you guys got?
I'll kick us off. I think a lot of times these are the lines when I was growing up that my friends and I would glom onto as quotable lines, and they just hang out in the background. But the one we used to say all the time in completely non sequitur related situations was from Karate Kid, when he goes, "Put him in a body bag." the way he says that, it's just so good. It's just anyways, so that's the one for me.
I bet if I thought about it, I could come up with dozens of these, because throwaway lines are one of my favorite aspects of television and film. But I settled on I think it's Brad Garrett in Finding Nemo, when they're being told about Nemo and the sharks, or Marlin and the sharks. And he's like, "Three sharks, that's got to be 4,800 teeth." And we just move right on. And I just love that. That is a fish we just learned who knows exactly how many teeth sharks have, because he thinks he's going to get eaten by one.
Mm-hmm. And can multiply by 3 very quickly.
Yes, he does math.
Also
well.
Good at math.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's another one we did. There was a movie we did. An interview for a few years ago, The Werewolves Within. The guy who did that did something recently. I can't remember what that was. It was that Valentine movie that came out around Valentine's. What was that? I'm looking this up. Sorry, guys. Josh Rubin did Werewolves
with
Hard Eyes. He did that. He also did this movie called Werewolves Within, which we interviewed him for. And there's a scene in there where, like, all the characters are in this, like, house or hotel or something like that, and there's this door that's closed, and inside the keyhole there's like an eyeball that's there, and the people are talking to the eyeball, and there's a point where just you know, there's the characters behind the door, we only see their eyeball, and when they ask this person behind the door what's going on and they answer, there's all this commotion, and you hear someone in the background go, "What did the eyeball say?" And I just really, really enjoyed that it's this, and it's ADR too. I asked him about that line, and they said, "Yeah, we just threw in a whole bunch of jokes and then, like, pared it down to get to this to the ones that we really liked." And I just really enjoy moments like that, where they just kind of like just let it go loose and everything. So over in the chat, Castro says that scene in The Dark Knight, I love this one, that scene in The Dark Knight where the mob guy is like, "You think you can just steal from us?" And Joker just says, "Yeah." This is no more further argument. Shaggy says, "I am the walrus." Let's see. Tatsu says, "One of the Halloween movies, the dad says, 'I got peanut butter on my penis.'" Oh, yes. I remember that as well. Logan Lucky, "Did you just say cauliflower to me?" So, yeah, those are all good ones for sure. Thank you guys for that one. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Next week is Secondhand Lions. Looking forward to seeing that for the very first time. Chat, thank you very much for coming out today. We appreciate you. So yeah, we'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hair, long, greasy hair. But I also may be touching it too much. That's the other thing. Like, I probably just need to leave it alone.
It's just like everything. Everything, like...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. I probably touch it too much. That is probably
right.
the truth about everything.
And I'm talking about, you know, that little place in your mouth where, mm-hmm. you know, don't touch it with your tongue. It just makes it worse.
Yeah. The uvula.
The uvula, exactly.
Just walk in.
Don't touch your uvula, Jeremy.
That word's always going to sound naughty to me, even though I know it's not.
Because there's a V in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and half the words with V's in them are naughty words.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
There's an episode of Friends where Penn Jillette comes by and sells the V of an encyclopedia, the V volume, to Joey, because he only has enough money for one of the volumes, and he chooses V. And then later in the coffee house, he keeps trying to bring up conversations. Like, how about that Vesuvius? That was some igneous rock formation, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, speaking of volcanoes, and they change the subject, and he's like, oh, he gets frustrated.
You talk about falling outs, and you just mentioned Penn Jillette, and it's interesting because Penn and Teller, like, they aren't friends at all, like, off stage. Like, they are, you know, not, like, enemies, but they say the reason they haven't become, like, mortal enemies, like, falling out and that kind of stuff, is because they just don't interact off stage. Like, they just go their separate ways and have no contact with each other.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so that's... I actually recently saw an interview with both of them where Teller was doing most of the talking, ironically enough. It was interesting to hear them talk about that. And even to watch them together in that interview, like you sense that they don't really like each other. That they just wouldn't hang out in real life.
Well, I mean, how many famous bands do we know,
right,
that have volatile relationships? Like the Police. The Police got together again to play at one of their guys' weddings, and they had a fight on stage at the wedding.
Simon and Garfunkel, you know,
yeah.
Everybody just like, yeah, I'm sick.
Oasis. It took 25 years for Oasis to get over their crap and start touring again.
Somebody asked me, like, what was something related to a political thing, like this person is coming back, and then so therefore this band has decided to reunite or whatever. And I was like, what's the most likely band for that to happen? And I threw out REM as a possible band that could do that or whatever. But then he's like, what do you think about the Police? And I said, the original Lynyrd Skynyrd would have a better chance of getting back together.
So are we looking at an all West Coast World Series here?
I thought
baseball
right
was over. Isn't baseball over? I must have gotten confused. I thought the season ended.
But if that's the case, they'll start some of the games early, right?
They'll all be at the normal time that they're always at. They'll still start at 7 o'clock.
Our time.
Which means on the West Coast, the people getting to those games are the ones inconvenienced because they've got to go during rush hour traffic to get to a game.
Yeah. Nice. And it's already a pain in the ass to get into Dodger Stadium as it is.
Oh, it's the worst. It's the fucking worst. So, but yeah, they'll still start those. I think they've already got the times set for those. So like, it won't change just because it's Dodgers Mariners. So.
Good. I was worried I was going to have to like stay up till 1 a.m. every single, I mean, I do anyway, but like not for baseball.
Keep in mind that by the time this particular episode airs, it could have completely changed, and it's Brewers Blue Jays or some other iteration that we were not discussing. So
yeah,
At this point, I'm rooting for anybody but L.A.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just rooting for the occasional amazingness that was that double play in the Dodgers game.
That double play was awesome. So great.
Mm-hmm. That was awesome. Did you guys see in the, you probably did, in the Tigers series, the guy who had the shirt that said dump number 61 here?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Cal Raleigh hit his 61st home run, and that guy freaking caught the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. then he took his shirt off, and he had another one that said, dump number 62 here. Like,
he was prepared.
That is fuel for my simulation theory right there. That's absurd that the ball went to that guy.
The question then becomes, though, how many other people may have had signs that said hit 61 here, and it just happened to go to that particular one?
That's fair. Crush my magic with your logic. I want to think that's one of the dumbest things I could think to do, but there are people who free climb like the Burj Khalifa and other super tall buildings and then video themselves, and sometimes those people die.
Yeah. That's what the thing that's still hard for me. I mean, we watch a movie like Free Solo and we're like, man, that Alex Honnold, is he ever like just the most fearless person ever? And he's just great at what he does and everything. But in that very movie, there are discussions of other greatest all time climbers who were the best of the best. Eventually, that shit can get you, you know? It's like we hold Alex Honnold in high esteem, and I don't want anything to happen to him, but my God, man.
Yeah,
it's
there was literally a week or two ago, one of the rising climbers in the world fell off El Capitan and died because he didn't tie off the end of his line.
Jesus.
Yeah, there's an interesting discussion about, like, a society's responsibility to protect its citizens, you know, and how free do you let people be to be dangerous? And, you know, you hear people on one side throw around phrases like nanny state, you know, I got to buckle my seatbelt, you know, or whatever it is. And then we have these other things where people can just climb sheer rock faces with no, you know, safety harness. And that's legal. That's completely legal, but I can't get into my car without buckling up. That's illegal. Like, it's a really interesting dichotomy and hypocrisy that you know, it's hard for society to figure out.
In that specific instance, the seatbelt law is to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not to protect other drivers.
Same with the helmet law. You know, like, it's
when you ride a bike, you got to have a helmet. That is weird. Now, those guys that climb buildings, that's not legal.
Like, no.
There was even three guys in Nashville earlier this year that climbed up the Batman building and tried to hide in a bathroom and eventually got caught and arrested.
That's a property issue, though.
Right.
That's what's so amazing about Man on Wire, like all the dodging they had to do with the security and everything to even make that happen is an amazing story in of it itself. So
don't
like,
we think there's a little insanity to people that would like, I can't look at that guy and see somebody who's completely sane. I can't.
I think exactly what Free Solo had an allusion to in the movie itself was Alex Honnold doesn't have that part of the brain that gets scared of things that all of us normies do. And I think the same thing can apply to people who drive 200 mile an hour race cars and people who do that high wire act, all these type of things. They just don't have that thing. It's just like, there's people out there who don't have a sense of touch, which is God, I can't even imagine what that would be like. But they have to be very careful about what they do because they could be bleeding out and just not know it.
Yeah.
And burn their hand off on a stove and
like
not
that
know
Jack
it.
Jack Quaid movie.
I was gonna say
he stuck his hand in the boiling oil to get the gun.
It's just like that Jack Quaid movie. Yes.